So I'm speaking this morning with Harlan Schober, Mike Horner, and Ted Dreyer of PEST, the People's Equipment and Supply Team, which garnered considerable visibility in 2016-2017 when it refurbished a school bus to serve as a mobile medical unit for Standing Rock. Most recently, PEST has been involved in some of the most creative and interesting regional actions, from light projections on buildings condemning the unfolding genocide in Gaza to refurbishing an old fire truck into the World on Fire truck that's been used in, multiple actions around Portland and beyond, including to resist the threatened expansion of Zenith Energy's capacity to transport and store volatile fuels in the critical energy infrastructure hub in Northwest Portland. So thanks for joining me today.
Glad to be here, Desiree.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Can you all talk a little bit about your organizing backgrounds and how those have informed the work that you did at Standing Rock and more recently at the intersections of climate justice and militarism? And maybe we can start with Mike.
The launching point for me was for my Portland activism was the trip to Standing Rock, where Harlan and I sort of joined forces and rented a truck and loaded it up with stuff and went to see what was happening there. And also, I went to the Philippines with on a human rights mission there with the local PCHRP and IHRP group, and spent 10 days in the Philippines and was at the inauguration of Duterte in 2016. And and it's all sort of just taken off from there.
I hadn't been politically active until around the time of Standing Rock. I'd been going to a few meetings, but there was something really compelling about the Standing Rock occupation. We met people there from all over the place. The first person I talked with was an indigenous guy who'd traveled from Peru to be at Standing Rock. There was a groundswell of enthusiasm for that. So we outfitted a school bus with insulation and a heater and a bunch of bunks and took it there for people to use. Came back. We were in fact outfitting it during the Trump election, the first time in 16. And we did a second bus, and then since then have done spotlight things with gobos, putting words and pictures on walls with light. And then in 2020, we got a hold of the school bus that XR had acquired, and we've been running that ever since.
Fire truck.
Yeah, thank you. The transition from school buses to fire trucks. Yeah.
You started by outfitting the school bus for a medical clinic at Standing Rock.
Well, I'd say it was, we hoped it would be used as a medical clinic. What we built in was just a number of bunks. I think it had eight bunks in it. And we insulated it and we provided a propane heater that could at least try to keep the space warm in the North Dakota winter. We understand it got, even with that heater running full blast, it got really cold in there. And we donated it to one of the clinics operating at Standing Rock. We brought that one back from Standing Rock when things wound down there. And we had two buses at that point. And one of them we donated to an indigenous group that was doing herbal medicine, and they would follow the canoe journey every year.
Yes.
So they followed that. And the other bus was donated to another indigenous group, and I don't know what use it's been put to.
Ted, do you want to jump in and talk a little bit about your own organizing background?
Sure, thank you. So I've been an activist since 1968 when I participated in the demonstrations basically against the Vietnam War outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. But since I retired as a public school teacher, I've had more time, so I participated in Portland's version of Occupy Wall Street. I worked with Greenpeace for a while, and I have been on the board of a couple of predominantly Native American groups, and therefore I was really interested in the Standing Rock demonstrations. And when I found out that Harlan and Mike were creating a bus to go to Standing Rock, I signed up immediately and was delighted to be able to accompany them both on the three trips that we took.
Thank you. And I mean, I just want to double back a little bit also to Mike, your organizing history, right? Because I know that you also, you know, you served in the Vietnam War, you were involved with Veterans for Peace, you worked also in prosthetics, right? I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you know, those links and sort of, you know, how you make these connections to climate justice.
I started out activism in the 70s against the Seabrook nuclear plant, and then I lived in Maine at the time. So, and also against the Maine Yankee plant in Maine. And but in that time, the Veterans for Peace was being initially organized by a couple of vets in near Portland, Maine. And I happened to go with a fellow that I was in business with to one of their meeting, to their almost their first meeting. And I found that they were bringing kids, the organization was bringing kids over from Bosnia. And this was during the Bosnia-Herzegovina war. And there were, of course, as always, there were lots of people getting blown up and a lot of children getting blown up and needing surgery and operations and prosthetics and whatnot. And then in 1994, I pulled up stakes and left Maine and went to Spokane to go to school for prosthetics and orthotics technician stuff, which basically involves building arms and legs and braces. So all along the way, everything I read, everything I knew, the casualties and the people that suffered traumatic injuries, you know, besides being run over by their grandfather's lawnmower, mostly are war time, you know, trauma. You know, after coming back from the Vietnam War, I was appalled, you know, by what I had seen and what I had done, you know, or what I had been part of. And from then on, it was really, I was looking differently at the military and what it meant. And the more I learned about the military and just how wide ranging it was and how destructive it was and how polluting it was, it just became kind of a no-brainer to oppose the largest military in the world, and clearly a military that was not serving the people. It was not supporting anything but capitalist expansionism.
Capitalism, of course, is based on endless monetary expansion. The stock market has to continually increase and increase. And the only way it can do that is by ignoring the needs of human beings and life on the planet altogether. Examples of racism are, unfortunately, all over the place. We dehumanize certain groups, but basically, capitalism is dehumanizing every human being and all living things, so that Ashley Dawson, for example, in a great history of extinctions that he published in 2016, says capitalism is the main cause of the sixth great extinction. And other scholars like Richard Smith have come to the same conclusion, so that there is an immediate connection between capitalism and racism and extinction. And because all of this is coming to a head as capitalism reaches a sort of crisis, because it's impossible to keep expanding, it resorts more and more to brute military force. And we see that in an extreme case in the USA enthusiastically supporting genocide in Israel. But also now sending troops to Los Angeles. That brute reliance on military force has always been present, but it's becoming more and more transparent and harder, I hope, for many people to ignore as we see that military expansionism projected against now our own people right here at home.
El derecho de vivir sin miedo en nuestro país, en conciencia y unidad con toda la humanidad. Ningún cañón borrará el surco de la hermandad.
That was an all-star lineup of Chilean artists singing Victor Jara's El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, or The Right to Live in Peace. Jara was tortured and killed in the wake of the U.S.-supported coup that resulted in the assassination of the democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende and installed the fascist dictator Augusto Pinochet. And now we return to my pre-taped interview with Mike Horner, Harlan Schober, and Ted Dreyer of PEST.
Both Ted and Mike had been involved in actually doing something about these things much longer than me. But it's been apparent to me for most of my life that we're kind of all on this collective rocket sled ride, and the brick wall is getting closer and closer. So there's that general unease. So this activism for me is kind of self-serving. It's an antidote to despair. And we've got this immense climate crisis that's already in motion. And now we're diverting the attention to some extent because we have this constitutional crisis with the orange felon trying to take over the whole business. And I think that's our primary duty right now, is to fill the streets, write to the people that can be written to. I mean, we've all made the commitment to nonviolence, so the current constitutional catastrophe is kind of front of mind for almost everyone I know. And we just want to encourage everyone to get in the streets and show up.
Kind of wanted to back up for a minute to talk a little bit about your projection work specifically, right? And, you know, recently you all came and gave a talk as part of the Thin Green Line is People's History Project Speakers Bureau, right? You came and gave a talk at Many Nations Academy and brought the fire truck and showed these high schoolers kind of the work that you're doing. Originally, the painting of the school bus that went as a medical clinic to Standing Rock was done at NEA, and that was done, I think the main artist was Asa Wright, is that right? Who happened to have a relative in among the high schoolers that you are speaking to at Many Nations. So that was kind of an interesting connection there. Some of your projection now is really about Gaza. And I think, you know, I just want to say too, I think there's some really obvious connections between, Mike, your work as a prosthetic technician and the production of, you know, what Jasbir Puar calls the production of debility in Gaza, right? The fact that, you know, in addition to the incredibly high body counts, there are massive numbers of people losing limbs, right? So this enormous profit that's being generated by the war machines at the expense of, you know, living, breathing folks in Gaza, including the many, many children losing their limbs and as well as their entire families.
We now have a tradition of going to Fleet Week with our projections, and we put messages on the side of the boats, which, you know, the powers that be are not terribly happy about. But so far we haven't been arrested, and that's good. We were at the New Year's celebration at Pioneer Square this year, and they had the big drone show, you know, and all that stuff. So we brought our own drone-themed gobo there to project, which, you know, showed a picture on the wall of a family, like a mom, kid, and a dad, and they were all in the crosshairs of some sort of a weapon. and the title was Israeli Drones Kill Kids, because Israeli drones are actually target children and shoot them in very specific ways, in the head, you know, in the chest, you know, in ways that are not accidental. So we wanted to bring that out while this crowd was celebrating with the oohs and ahs of this, you know, sort of fancy light show in the sky. And, you know, we got overwhelmingly supportive comments. We had a few people tried to disrupt us, but and the police tried to shut us down, but we didn't go. We have lots of critical messages about stop arming Israel. You know, stop mass starvation is a crime, is a war crime. Bombing hospitals is a war crime. These are things that should be obvious. And we also do a lot of light projection around immigration. You know, a lot of this stuff that's going on with ICE has happened before. And we have a whole stack of gobos about immigration issues and stuff, which are getting dusted off now and brought back out. There's a huge need for things like light projection because it's startling. It gets people's attention, just like the fire truck.
Too, I know you all were a regular fixture at Occupy ICE, like projecting on, you know, I don't know if it was directly on the ICE Center, on the building across the street. Like, what is it about light projection that is so exciting? I mean, that you can turn the side of a ship into you know, medium for your message.
Believe me, we talk a lot about messaging and just how to make sure that we're not projecting messages that only speak to the choir. It's always good to try and take a fresh look at your message and make sure that it's something that a Joe going down the street or a Jill going down the street will immediately recognize, is something that they can relate to. We have a large group of people that we talk to. Our friend Ken Huey is a graphic artist and a comic guy. He does comics. He's a very good thinker. He's really good on messaging. The art of the message is really the art that I'm interested in.
Yeah, Harlan, you were going to jump in.
Sure. We've been helped a lot by a friend who is a professional sign painter. And Mike has learned lettering and layout and does many hand-built banners, some of them quite large. The banners that we use on the fire truck are like 20 feet long by 4 feet high. The newer ones are 10 feet long by 5 foot high. This may be a chance to put in a plug. We would always like to work with new volunteers who would like to go out at night and put light on the wall, or volunteers who would like to come along and help paint banners and possibly ride on the fire truck. We try to dispatch with a crew of two instead of just one driver. I think that we should call ourselves sloganistas.
I wonder if we can just, you know, pivot and talk more specifically about the World on Fire truck and sort of how you all ended up buying a used fire truck and turning it into this incredible organizing tool.
Well, Extinction Rebellion Portland acquired this truck in 2019. And we used it one time that year. And then for a number of reasons, it was not being much used. It was basically given to Mike and me, Pest at the time. And we got it in 2020. And we were driving around our first time out with a banner on it, vote like your house is on fire, because we'd had those big fires. And we got a text by phone that there was a Black Lives Matter march in Lake Oswego. We showed up there and we found ourselves corking for the march. And it really took off from there.
For those who are unfamiliar with that term, corking, can you define that for us?
Yeah, thank you. Especially with the George Floyd protests in 2020, which were just large and constant and really inspiring, there developed in Portland a whole team of people who would control traffic so that marchers could occupy streets and no one got run over, and we could deal with traffic conflicts And that population of people who use bicycles, motorcycles, and cars to control traffic to protect a march, they got really good at it. And we would get used as, in the fire truck, we would get used to usually take up the rear and claim a lane or two so that vehicle traffic couldn't overtake pedestrians.
Ted, did you want to kind of jump in a little bit?
If I can go back to the importance of the light images, just briefly at least, I just wanted to add that during the Black Lives Matter protest, which got, as everybody remembers, pretty crazy, the importance in that chaos of having these amazing images projected right on the Multnomah County Justice Center, so that you have, you know, images of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter right up there, enormous images, and the police who were, you know, shooting people with projectiles and other flying, exploding items and tear gas, couldn't do anything about, they couldn't reach up and erase those images. It was really moving and inspiring. I remember a couple of times that Mike and I grabbing the projector and running because the tear gas got too intense. But basically, it was the effect of art in this case is really inspiring and motivating, and it's quite impressive. And of course, the fire engine in its way serves the same purpose. So many times before a demonstration even starts, people will come up to the fire engine and ask about it. What is this? It fascinates people, it attracts people, and in action, moving along with a march or on the edge of a demonstration, it also has the same inspiring effect. It gathers people's attention, it focuses their attention, it inspires them, and it excites them because it's so unusual.
Okay, and you can have like massive, you know, the massive capital that it takes to build this building, right? And you all kind of occupy it visually in some startling, uncontrolled ways. Can you talk a little bit about other kind of artivist traditions that you might be drawing on?
In this last year, we've done puppets. So there was a 350 put on a class and brought Donovan Zimmerman, came from, I think, North Carolina. And he's been for 30 some years making puppets for street demonstrations and such. So we're trying to fold these things together. Now we have puppets that we can get a hold of, that some of them take six people to operate. Some of them are single person puppets, but they're kind of larger than life things. And we were in the St. John's Parade this year, for example, with the fire truck and people with puppets and a band on top of the fire truck and with banners and slogans. And it was a festive day. The music was festive. The messages were good. And the puppets are really elevating. They're almost all fanciful creatures, like a large crane and a fish with a jaw that opens and closes and the tail wags. And altogether, there's a lot of artistry going into these messages.
I feel like we're bannering and stuff, inflatables like Backbone Campaign out of Vashon Island. You know, they were instrumental in the kayaktivist thing, which has since become a thing in Portland. They've sort of pioneered the net banners, you know, that I think are brilliant and very easy to handle. And they make large banners possible to do on the water, which is pretty cool because otherwise you're just in big trouble with a big sail. They have pioneered a lot of fabulous techniques for getting messages out, you know, and they do light projection. Seems to me they may have been the ones that introduced us to light projection. Bill Moyer, I think. And then And then they also do inflatables. They put together these sort of coordinated shows. You know, if they show up a place and it's nighttime and they can do lights and it's about whales, they'll bring an inflatable whale. They are also into big props. And I think big props are the way to go. I consider the fire truck to be a big prop. You know, it's out of the ordinary. I consider light projection to be a big prop because it grabs attention.
Yeah, and I know Bill Moyer comes at it from a background in theater, right? So you really are bringing like this theater into the streets. And, you know, there is that very long tradition of that. So, you know, your work is just so interesting. It brings so much energy to the movement. And I know, Harlan, you mentioned earlier that you all are open to sort of training up new organizers, you know, having people ride along. You've got this bandstand now on top of the truck. Yeah, how can people get in touch and find out how they can plug in and support your work and maybe learn light projection?
We have now a Facebook page dedicated to the fire engine primarily, and we do have a web page. The World on Fire Department is the name of our web page.
All right. Well, thank you all so much.